This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Jazakumullah khair everyone for joining us today for this special event that we have with our brother Muhammad Hijab. It is a very great honor for myself to be hosting this event today. It's almost historical. In fact, it is historical, this event that we have, not only in terms of the physical stature of the guests that we have, but also in terms of the grandness and the significance of this particular event. This event is being hosted in situ, in the Southeast Technological University, by the Muslim Students Association in the Waterford campus. This Muslim Students Association was just set up recently in the last few months, and this, in fact, is the second event that they are hosting, so quite a big event, and it's an absolute pleasure to personally have this event being hosted in my own city, where I grew up, where I was born, in Waterford, the best city in Ireland, might I add. So also, Jazakallah khair to all those who came travelling from different cities. I know that a number of people came from Dublin, of course, from Cork. We have a number of students from UCC. Actually, I didn't really mean to mention Dublin, to be honest, but we also have brothers and sisters from Galway. I was very impressed that we had some brothers and sisters from Galway and Limerick to attend this particular event. So inshallah, in many ways, this is quite a national event that we are hosting. This is part of a tour that we have with Muhammad Hijab for his Ireland tour. Yesterday, we were in the prestigious Trinity College Dublin, and tomorrow we will be in Queen's University in Belfast, so we'll be back in the UK. But we don't need to delve into that second part of the statement, inshallah. Just one thing that I want to mention before we begin with recitation of Quran, as we usually do for our events with the Ali Brothers and with any of the MSA events that we have. I am very impressed by the work that this particular committee, the MSA of C2, have been doing. As a president for the last 2 years in Trinity College Dublin, the MSA there, and being a part of the committee for the last 2.5 years, I know just how difficult and how time-consuming and how much effort it takes to arrange events like this and to arrange them in a way that is professional, in a way that they are successful. So I do want to ask all of you to join me in giving a big round of applause to the committee of the Muslim Student Association here in the Southeast Technological University in Waterford. With that, inshallah, without further ado, we will begin the event with recitation of Quran. A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. لله ما في السماوات وما في الأرض وإن تبدوا ما في أنفسكم أو تخفوه يحاسبكم به الله فيغفر لمن يشاء ويعذب من يشاء والله على كل شيء قدير آمن الرسول بما أنزل إليه من ربه والمؤمنون كل آمن بالله وملائكته وكتبه ورسله لا نفرق بين أحد من رسله وقالوا سمعنا وأطعنا غفرانك ربنا وإليك المصير لا يكلف الله نفسا إلا وسعها لها ما كسبت وعليها ما اكتسبت ربنا لا تؤاخذنا إن نسينا أو أخطأنا ربنا ولا تحمل علينا إصرا كما حملته على الذين من قبلنا ربنا ولا تحملنا ما لا طاقة لنا به واعف عنا واغفر لنا وارحمنا أنت مولانا فانصرنا على القوم الكافرين Sadaqallahu al-Azim. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce our guest of honor for this evening. Muhammad Hijab is an author, comparative religionist, and philosopher of religion. He is the co-founder of the Sapience Institute and a researcher and instructor for the organization. He has a BA in politics and a master's in history. He has also acquired a second master's in Islamic studies from the School of Oriental and African Studies. Mr. Hijab has also completed a third master's degree in applied theology from the University of Oxford, where he focused on the philosophy of religion in applied settings. Hijab is now pursuing his PhD in the philosophy of religion on the contingency argument for God's existence. He has amassed a whopping following of over 1.1 million followers or subscribers on YouTube on his main channel. And recently he has gone viral with a number of interviews that he has done, namely the ones with Piers Morgan on the issue of Palestine and the debate that he has done recently with Rabbi Shmuley, although Mr. Hijab will correct me in saying that his true name is actually Unholy Shmuley, but that is for him to explain further. Jazakumullah khair, please join me in giving a warm Irish and Southeastern welcome to our brother Muhammad Hijab.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Can everyone hear me quite well here, or is the microphone close enough, or should I? Today's topic is going to be about the meaning of life, but what I really want to do is interact with everyone in this room. So I'm going to try and keep my speech to a minimum so that I can interact with you guys in questions and answers, because I think that's really where the benefit is. Well, I want to start off by saying, in terms of the meaning or the purpose of life, is the following. What are the things that almost every human being from any worldview would agree with human beings from other worldviews on? Number one, that there is something rather than nothing. Number two, that we live in a universe. Number three, that the universe is regular, it is uniform, and it is stable. And it's regular, uniform, and stable to the extent to which it allows humans or any kind of life to exist. These are what you would really call incontrovertible facts. These are things which don't seem to be controversial. So, number one, that there is something rather than nothing. Number two, that there's a universe. Number three, that this universe is stable. It is uniform. It is regular. The extent to which it allows life to exist within it. Now, I have one question and one question only, which is, what is the best explanation for that? Now, there's really two things, two exhaustive things that one can say about these state of affairs. A, that this is due to an intelligence, or B, that this is not due to an intelligence. Now, if I were to put it just like that, without even making an argument, effectively, this is just me asking a question. If I were to speak to an atheist, for example, or a materialist, or an agnostic or something, I would start with these facts laid bare in this cold, rational manner. I would say, let's agree on the fact that we live in a universe. Let's agree on the fact that this universe exhibits regularity and stability and uniformity. Now, what is the best explanation for this? Is it intelligence or lack of intelligence? So if they say, well, lack of intelligence, to be honest with you, I don't mind absconding from the conversation altogether at that point, because I don't see that as a reasonable reply. Because if someone says it's a lack of intelligence, what is it then? Someone may argue that it's chance. It's just by chance and randomness that we came into this position. My response to that is, chance doesn't actually exist. There's no evidence that chance exists. What is chance? If you look at definitions of what chance are, chance is effectively randomness. It's interesting because if you look at definitions of what randomness is, they use the word chance. And if you look at the definitions of what chance is, they use the word randomness. But is chance an active force? Is chance something which can be empirically verified? Is chance something which I can see, that I can touch, that I can smell, that I can interact with any of my five senses. Chances, none of those things, or any of those things. And so what is chance exactly? What is it an expression of? It's an expression of things we don't understand. And Simon Laplace is a very interesting philosopher, 19th century philosopher. He's written a book about this, actually. And he talks about the fact that if, he calls it the demon hypothesis, he says if there was a creature, and this creature knew everything about the past and the present and the future, knew everything, all the variables, and he says that this creature had all this information, then he would know, or this creature would know, the future. Effectively, that which we label on this view as randomness and chance is just simply that which we are ignorant of. Since everything has a cause and has an explanation, the things that happen which we don't understand, which we call chance and randomness, are in fact things which we don't know why they've acted in that way. We don't know why is it that A caused B in this way. We don't know what the effective cause or the efficient cause or the material cause or the final cause of that thing is. We don't know what that is. And hence, we call it random. It happened randomly, we say. But that is not a good explanation as to why this thing, random, exists in the first place. In short, therefore, randomness is not some substratum that you can put under a microscope or some force which you can detect. There is no evidence that randomness exists. If an atheist says to me, this universe can be described as uniform and regular and stable as a result of randomness, I will say, please prove the existence of such randomness. I myself am an atheist or an agnost or a disbeliever in the concepts of randomness which you propose. And the burden of proof is upon the one that's making the claim. So randomness cannot be an explanation for why the universe is uniform, is regular, and is stable. So then what could be another explanation? Someone could say the universe is as it is because the universe is like this by necessity. Necessity is that it's like this without an explanation, without a cause. It just is. That's what Bertrand Russell said. He said, the universe just is. Okay, why is it the way it is? Well, no, the universe just is. Even if someone proposes this idea, that the universe, the laws of the universe, the laws of nature, are as a result of necessity, there is no contradiction in believing that this universe was designed and it was necessarily designed. So necessity does not negate design. There is no contradiction between necessity and design. In fact, the theists would agree. He said, look, it's all qadr of Allah anyway. It's all determined. Because if you say the universe is determined the way it is, then the question is, what determined it? If the universe is determined, if these laws are determined, the uniformity and the regularity and the stability of the universe is determined, the question is, what determined it? You say nothing determined it. Then I respond, how can something come from nothing? In which case, you've got nothing to say. And so, if you do an exhaustive, disjunctive analysis of the options that are possible in explaining, in best inference terms, why is the universe stable? Why is it uniform? Why is it regular? To the extent to which it allows human life or any kind of life to exist and continue existing. Why? What's the best explanation for that? We go back to, is it intelligence or lack thereof? Or is it no intelligence? And if someone says, it's no intelligence, well, that's no explanation at all. And so we would say that the best explanation for why the universe is the way it is and facilitates what it facilitates is in fact design. That is the best explanation. Richard Dawkins would disagree. And he would say, well, hold on. That's what we used to think back in the day. Now we have the evolutionary mechanism. In fact, he wrote a whole book called The Blind Watchmaker. By the way, if you think about it, if it's a blind watchmaker, because he was responding to someone called William Paley, and William Paley said that if you walk in a particular desert or something like that, and you see a watch, called it the watchmaker's argument, He says that this watch exhibits traits of what he called contrivance, which is design. So if you see a watch, it exhibits design. Compare a watch with a rock. The rock doesn't have such design. The watch does have the design. And so you know that there's been some kind of manufacturing process that has been imposed on that particular watch. You don't know that when it's a rock. And you don't even need to think about it. It comes intuitive to you that there was some kind of manufacture for this watch. So Richard Dawkins responds to this and he says, well, actually, we have now the evolutionary mechanism. If you watch even one of those National Geographic programs, the word evolution will be mentioned. David Attenborough, and he'll talk about this, and evolutionary mechanism. First thing I will say is that even if one presupposes the evolutionary mechanism, a mechanism is different from agency. Just because there's a mechanism, it doesn't mean that it's unguided. If Richard Dawkins is responding, he says, actually, it's a blind watchmaker. But there's still a watchmaker in your analogy. It doesn't matter if he's blind or not. There's still a watchmaker. There's an agency there. By calling him a blind watchmaker, it doesn't solve the problem. If that makes sense. The second thing I will say is this. You can speak about evolution all you like when it comes to biology. But when it comes to physics, there is no evolution. And the Quran, interestingly, it responds to this kind of thought process, where it says, لَخَلْقُ السَّمَوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضِ أَكْبَرُ مِنْ خَلْقِ النَّاسِ. That actually, the creation of the heavens and the earth is bigger than the creation of the human beings. Why are we focusing on biological species when there is no such thing as a theory of evolution in physics? There is no, because with celestial spheres and inanimate objects, there is no evolutionary mechanism. It doesn't even apply. So still the question will remain, how can you explain the uniformity and the regularity and the stability of those inanimate forces? And there will be no response. And so when you think about this, all of the proposed responses to this very basic question of why is it that the universe exhibits these traits, they are all non-starters, self-refuting. They don't go that far. And so one doesn't need to spend a long time making arguments for God's existence. All one really needs to do is ask one simple question. What is the best explanation for what you see around you? And if someone responds in the ways that I've just mentioned, which frankly are the only ways someone can respond. Someone can say, well, there's a multiverse. That's another thing someone can say. But I didn't ask about a multiverse, I asked about this universe. Say, well, if there's a million universes just like this, it's one of them is bound to have these proportions and be regular and stable and uniform. But that's not the question I ask. I'm not asking about a million universes, which are unproven anyway. You haven't seen a million universes. I'm asking about this universe. So they've changed the goalposts. They say, okay, well, if you have a million universes, having one universe that's like this, it's not that special. That's the response that some of them give. My response to that is that, well, I'm not speaking about a million imaginary universes, which no one can prove. I'm talking about this universe. What's the explanation for the fact that this universe is uniform, regular, and stable? So when you exhaust all the possibilities, I'm sorry to say, there is no excuse for thinking that this universe came from chance or came from nothing or is necessarily like this or is because of a multiverse or something like that. There is no excuse for believing these fairy tales and misnotions, the delusions, that you're trying to run away from the reality and the easy answer. You're trying to run away from the... Because really and truly, it's not about the intellectual thing. You know that the moment you acknowledge that there is a designer of the universe, there's going to be some kind of ethical and moral responsibility on you. Because the question will then be, so what does this designer want from us? Why has this designer done this? Why is he created? Why is he designed? Well, the Quran asks that question. It says, أَفَحَسِبْتُمْ أَنَّمَا خَلَقْنَاكُمْ عَبَثًا وَأَنَّكُمْ إِلَيْنَا لَا تُرْجَعُونَ. Do you think that we have created you purposeless, without aim, and that you will not be returned to us? Because if you think about it with care, the same entity that put things in the right place in order to achieve an effect, and the effect of having life in the universe, surely a deliberative entity like this did not put human being on a planet like Earth, imbued that human being with free will, and done all of that for no reason whatsoever. Surely that's not the case. Because if that is the case, it's almost inexplicable. So what is the purpose of life then? The purpose of life for the human being is to do that which everything else is doing, which is submitting to the laws of nature. The only difference between the human being, according to our narrative as Muslims, and everything else in nature is that everything else in nature is compelled to do that through the forces of nature and through the laws. Whereas the human being has a choice whether or not they would submit to the laws. Now, from then on out, we go into a religious narrative, and there are competing religions which try and explain how it is, or what the purpose of life is. Of course, Islam is one of those religions. And we can go into a discussion about what the specific proofs of Islam are. But the main point is to realize that there is a purpose of life. Once one realizes this point, then we can go into a discussion about, okay, what religion is true? Which one has the most evidences? How do we find out? That's another discussion. But at this juncture, all we need to do is realize that the notion, the universe is here, and it facilitates life. It's stable, it's uniform, it's regular. And that the entity responsible for this acts in aimless and purposeless ways, that proposition is a ludicrous proposition. It's a nonsensical proposition. And so therefore the human being does have purpose, objective purpose, not subjective purpose, objective, anchored and solid purpose. Once we get to that juncture, then we can discuss, okay, which religion is the correct one and all these kinds of things. But because I have spoken for about, 10, 15 minutes now? I think that's where people start losing their attention span, including myself. So what I'll do at this juncture is open it up to questions and answers immediately, inshallah. Sure. Yes, go ahead, yeah. Salam.
I've done some dawah before, and I've spoken to some atheists before, and so one argument sometimes they would make is that when you would make this argument about how like Islam is the closest of truth, because you compare it to the other other religions out there, other ideologies out there, they agree that Islam is close, is the truer of all of them, but they sometimes bring up like the black swan problem of what if there is maybe a different truth out there that is the correct one that we just don't know of. So why are you concluding that Islam is the truth just because the options that we have are even worse?
So the way I would do this is, the way I like to do this, since you've just asked the question, in trying to establish Islam as the religion of truth, apart from its competitors, is I distinguish between necessary and sufficient conditions, okay? Now, a necessary condition is something which, if it's not there, then the thing will not be there. The entire thing will not be there. Where a sufficient condition is something which is required as a higher burden of proof to prove something's existence. Let me give you an example, right? In Islam, you need a man and a woman to get married. You cannot have a man and a man. Okay, and I know many people don't understand this, and we can discuss that maybe in some other question. Or you cannot have a woman and a woman. Okay, but you need a man and a woman. Now, if I bring a man here and I bring a woman, I say, come sit here. Okay, and I say, I now pronounce you husband. It wouldn't be acceptable because that's not the sufficient condition. So in order to make it a sufficient condition, all I need is two witnesses, two male witnesses. And that's another discussion. Why is it male? Everything, there's another discussion. Over age, yes. And I also need a mahar, which is a dowry. The man will give it to the woman here. According to the Hanafis, that's enough now, by the way. But yani, if we go one step further, say, okay, and she needs to speak to her father or her wali. Once these three things are there, that's it. And ijab and qabul. By the way, yani, people will be surprised because people think that this is that all it takes to get married in Islam. That's actually all it takes to get married in Islam. I mean really and truly, I know this sounds ludicrous to some of you, say, that could take 10 seconds. It could take literally 1 minute. I've gotten people married in 1 minute, in 60 seconds, because I was busy. Honestly, someone comes to the office and say, listen, I need to get married, this and that. I say, listen, I need to go to the toilet. So this is going to have to be a quick one. You know, I say, 1, 2, 3, okay, husband and wife. I'll tell you the truth. I've even gotten people married on WhatsApp. And now there's a difference of opinion on the matter. But I was driving, and this guy, he called me. He said, look, I'm going to commit haram. That's what he said to me. I'm going to commit haram. He goes, I've got two witnesses ready on this WhatsApp group. Can I add you and you do the thing? I didn't know what to do about the situation. So I called my sheikh and he said, yes, there's some scholars, there's a discussion about it. You can do it. So I brought them in. I said to the woman, I said to her, listen, this guy's probably going to leave you. I know this guy. And he was like, what are you doing? You're here to try and make things easy for me. I said, but it's not fair on the poor woman. Because we know that you're a pernicious man, yeah? Or as the Urdu, they say, khabis, you're a khabis. Anyway, so it happened. Marriage happened. And I said, what's the mahar? And the guy said, you don't want to hear this one. This was before McDonald's was on the boycott list. He goes, I'm going to give her a meal in McDonald's. I said, sister, don't do this. I said, at least have something. No, she said, I don't mind. I don't care, you know, whatever, you know. It happened. And he did, in fact, divorce her, unfortunately. But I said, I told you so, and that was it. But that's how easy marriage is in Islam. But that's not the question you were asking. So if I had a man and a woman here, and then I got two witnesses, and I got the mahar. It's so simple. The marriage, they can go to the hotel after. I'm not saying they should do it like this. This is not culturally sensitive to many of the cultures of the world, but they can. I mean, this is all Islam asks to do. I mean, Islam doesn't say all of the other things that are, you know, has to this and that one, and walima, huh? Islam doesn't say that. Any book of fiqh doesn't say any of that. Just to let you know, yani. But it's not so. If I had a man and a woman here, a necessary condition is what? That they have to be man and woman. But it's not a sufficient condition, you see. For it to be a sufficient condition, you have to have two witnesses and the dowry. And according to the Jumhur, the wali as well. That would make it now a fully-fledged marriage. For example, when I got married, you know, in Pakistani culture, I was in Pakistan, that's why I keep talking. They have this thing called rukhsati and this and that, and you do nikah, and then after, you have to wait a few months for the... I want to tell you, the same thing, my wife, she's Moroccan, this is where she's from, originally. And they had the same thing. They said to me, you have to wait 3 months before, from the nikah until the walima. So I just said, oh really, oh very interesting. All these kind of things, yes? Have to wait. So then when I done the nikah, as soon as it happened, I went and I called her. I said, let's... she goes, well, did you hear what my dad said? I said, your dad is not in charge anymore. So it's none of his business what me and you do. I said, what, are you going to tell your dad every time we do this? I said, how dare you? I said, I've been waiting for 20 years. If you want to fight me, fight these tears. I said, at the end of the day, like, so we had to break the customs and whatever, you know, I'm not saying you should break the customs, but I did, I broke the customs, Ahi. I'm not going to wait no 3 months.
Sorry, brother, my attention span isn't great. What was the question again?
I don't know why I've gone into this tirade. So necessary and sufficient conditions, right? In Islam, you can say there are necessary things in order to prove that the book is, if this exists in the book, it's not from God. So for example, contradictions. You cannot have a book that claims to be from God but is filled with contradictions. Like for example, if I open the Bible, the very first page of the Bible, very first page, it says God created the day and the night, right? On the first day. But lo and behold, you look on the fourth day and he created the sun. I want to know, how is it there a day in the night without the sun? Okay, maybe it's just, maybe I'm reading into it too much, no problem. So I look on the third day, God created the what? The plantations and the shrubbery. But how can there be shrubbery without the sun? Because of photosynthesis. Okay, put that to the side. It gets worse because I flick the page over. And I see Genesis chapter 2, verse 5. And it says, no plant had sprung up yet. I thought you just said that there was plants in day 3. So there's plants, no plants. Sun, no sun. This, that. Contradictions. So much so that Origen of Alexandria, who's seen as a huge figure in Christianity. He's like the Abu Hanifa of Christianity. And he said that this is a contradiction. He admitted it in his book on first principles. So the first thing is, you can't have contradictions in a book that claims to be from God. The Bible, the first couple of pages, has at least 5 or 6 contradictions. At least. The second thing is that the book must be preserved. That's another necessary condition. Now, we all know that the Bible has not been preserved. There's no discussion of whether or not the Bible is corrupted. There is effectively consensus now. And we don't even need to talk about Torah. Because, by the way, what I've just said that relates to the Bible or the Christian faith also relates to the Jewish faith. Because the first 5 books is effectively the Torah. It's not preserved. It's filled with contradictions. So you disqualify, actually, the majority of religions when you just use the necessary conditions. You don't even need to go to the sufficient conditions. For example, the idea of God in Christianity, that you have the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, and all three of them are all-powerful, for example. Now, that's a contradiction, because how can you have 3 all-powerful beings? If all-powerful being one tried to supervene on the will of all-powerful being two, which of them is going to be successful? If it's A over B, then B is not the true God. If it's B over A, then A is not the true God. If A and B draw in some kind of a fight, they have a fight, and it was a draw, then both of them are not true gods, because how can a God draw in a fight? You know, this is... So what I'm saying is the idea of the Trinity, the Hindu gods, all of this stuff is, they're disqualifiers to the true religion. They don't fulfill the basic criterion of a true religion. So with just the necessary conditions, you cut through most of these false religions. And by that, by the way, you can just use that to find out Islam is true. But then we say that's not enough. Because just because a book does not have contradictions and it doesn't have, is preserved, it doesn't mean it's true. So we have what we call sufficient conditions. I'll give you one example of that, because I could be speaking for a very long time, which are the prophecies. Prophecies of the Quran and the Sunnah. Some religions, they talk about the future and they get things wrong. Once again, if you look at the Bible, you look at the Olivet Discourse. You can Google that in your own time. And the Olivet Discourse is about talking about the end of days. That's it. One generation, everything's going to be finished. Many religions, especially in the 18th and 19th century in America, these kind of New Age religions, they predicted the last day. And they got that wrong. They say the last day will be at this time, for example. Now, what I'm saying to you is, if you look at the prophecies of Islam, just look at one prophecy. In chapter 30, verses 1 to 6, غُلِبَتْ الرُّومِ فِي أَدْنَى الْأَرْضِ وَهُمْ مِنْ بَعْدِ غَلَبِهِمْ سَيَغْلِبُونَ فِي بِدْعِ سِنِينَ لِلَّهِ الْأَمْرُ مِنْ قَبْلُ وَمِنْ بَعْدُ وَيَوْمِ إِذٍ يَفْرَحَ الْمُؤْمِنُونَ. This verse, which is that the Romans have been defeated in a nearby low land, and that in 3 to 9 years that they will defeat the Persian Empire. This is a very risky thing, because if the claimant of such prophecy got it wrong, it would destroy his credibility. Especially if that claimant is saying that he is getting this information from God, the all-knowing one. The one who designed the universe and regulated it and stabilized it. And so what I'm saying is, even from non-Muslim sources, you find that this prophecy came to pass. Many prophecies came to pass. There's a book you can read called The Forbidden Prophecies by Abu Zakaria, which goes into detail about that. But this then formulates the second part of proving Islam's truth, which is the sufficient conditions. Obviously, we can speak a long time about just the prophecies and other things which prove Islam to be true. But suffice it for me to say that when you employ the method of looking at the necessary and sufficient conditions of each religion, Islam is the only one that comes out on top.
Jazakallah khair. We'll take another question from the... yes, brother.
Say that again. Sorry, a bit louder.
I wonder about faith and fear. How is the destination of knowledge of like it's good or bad, nothing beyond the knowledge? So my question is, if Allah knows what we do in the past, why does it prevent the disaster from this happening?
Okay. So this is a very common question about, okay, so God knows what's going to happen in the future. Why doesn't he prevent the bad things from happening? Or if God knows that we're going to do bad, then why does he allow us to go to hell? Or there's different formulations of this question. And it all goes back to a discussion about free will and determinism. Okay? So God, we believe, He knows the future, he has written the future, he wills the future, and he creates the future. But at the same time, we believe that we have free will. So how is it that God knows the future, he has written the future, he wills the future, and he creates the future, but at the same time, human being has free will? How can these two things come together? The answer is the mechanism by which these two things come together, no one knows. Because it relates to one of the attributes of God, which is the willing of God. How is it that human being can have a will which is compatible and works in symbiotic fashion with the will of God? The mechanism of that is unknowable, not even just unknown, unknowable to the human being. The same extent to which if I were to ask, how does God see? How does God hear? How does God know? All of those questions are unknowable to the human being. So too the question, how is it that human beings' will and human will are compatible with one another? Suffice it for me to say, though, that these discussions are being had outside of the Islamic theological circle. In fact, they're had in every single sect, secular and non-secular. For example, in philosophy, you have three schools of thought. One of them is determinism, the other one is compatibilism, and the third one is libertarian free will. And all of these schools of thought, they postulate something different about human beings' ability to will freely. And that's the connection between that and the antecedent causal chain. The point is that this is the mechanism of how this works is something which has plagued philosophers for the last 2,000 to 3,000 years. No one can spell out exactly how that works. I've seen so many analogies about the teacher, about this, about that. None of these analogies will be sufficient. I can tell you that for sure. None of these analogies, they can bring you closer to the fact, but there's no perfect analogy which can describe the relationship between qadr, or godly will, and human free will. However, what one can say is, both of those things can be they can be proven independently. For example, the most famous, probably, school of secular philosophy is something called compatibilism. And this postulates that human being has free will, but at the same time, there is determinism. There is a kind of determinism. How they come together, they'll tell you themselves. We don't know exactly how they come together. But the reason why we say that there is free will is because we have first-person subjective experiences. And all of rationalism starts with human beings' ability to realize that he exists and that they are doing things willfully. So free will is seen as foundational to anything else. At the same time, there's antecedent causal chains. How these two things come together, even though compatibilism is the most popular school in philosophy, even people who are non-Muslim believe in it. For example, John Locke believed in that. He was a liberal. I mean, John Stuart Mill believed in that. Many people were compatibilists who were not even Muslim. So they believed in the equivalent of free will and determinism, but they won't tell you the underlying mechanism because a full understanding of that is unknowable to the human being.
JazakAllah khair. We'll take another question there, inshallah. Yes, brother in the front.
Salam.
Basically, when I talk to atheists here and I tell them about the purpose of life and we need to worship one God, they just answer by, like, you know, if you are a good human being and you do good, you know, in life, you know, you don't hurt other people, that's it, you know, you go to paradise or something.
Okay.
So I would like to know your answer, because I have my answer.
But if they're atheists, why do they believe in paradise in the first place? I mean,
that's the most important for them.
Yeah,
not
yeah.
Worship.
That does come about. Like you say, well, I just don't harm anyone else or something like that, so long as I'm minding my own business. And what they're doing is they're parroting what you call liberal ethics. Okay? Look, the religion of the West nowadays is not Christianity anymore. It used to be. In this country, used to have serious infighting and all this kind of thing because of the Catholics and the Protestants. Now, I don't see how that can be relevant when a lot of the people are not even religious anymore. You see? So people have become more irreligious throughout the Western world, and especially in Europe and America. Not so much the Bible Belt, but that's the case in the West. So the point is this, is that they will, if you ask them what is it to be good, say so long as you're not harming anyone else, you're good. That is what you call liberal ethics. That's how they justify things like homosexuality. So if you ask them, what is the status of homosexuality as morality? They'll say it's fine, so long as the person's not harming anyone else. They're two consensual adults, what have you got to do with it? You know, you can be a good person and homosexual at the same time. Say, no problem. All you have to do for me right now is explain why the harm principle is true. Because what they're actually saying is something which requires evidence. This idea of the harm principle itself requires evidence. The idea that you are good, or you are doing good, so long as you are pleasing yourself or somebody else, and you're not harming anyone else. So what's the evidence that that's the case? What's the evidence that that constitutes true morality? What's the evidence? Now, if you ask their top philosophers, they will try and provide evidence, like John Stuart Mill. He tried to provide evidence for that. And that evidence, which he wrote in his book on utilitarianism, was inconclusive to say the least. In fact, I was just reading a book recently by John Gray, who is an atheist himself. He wrote a book called The Seven Types of Atheism. I was reading a new book of his called The New Leviathan. But in this book, he was critiquing John Stuart Mill on this basis. He himself, as a philosopher, he was saying, how could John Stuart Mill, as an empiricist, someone who believes in the scientific approach, he tried to effectively prove his ideas through non-empirical means. He didn't have a scientific way of proving any of his philosophical ideas. So this proposition that you can do whatever you want so long as you don't harm anyone else is unscientific, even though its proponents claim to be empiricists. There is no way of proving that. And in fact, you could prove the opposite of it. For example, let's go back to the case study of homosexuality, because it's a sensitive and controversial case study at the same time. You could argue that on consequentialist reasoning, because look, Western morality, that's religious, non-religious, is one of two schools. There's two schools of thought, effectively. What you call consequentialism, and what you call, if you like, categorical imperatives of Immanuel Kant, yeah? Consequentialism says something is good or bad based on its consequences. Who gets to decide what are the good or bad consequences? It's arbitrary. They don't have a way of doing it. But for the sake of argument, they'll say if something causes harm, for the sake of argument, it's bad. If something doesn't cause harm, it's good. It's okay. It can be done. So we look at homosexuality as a morality. We say, fine. If you look at it on a communal level, is there more evidence that it causes harm or is there more evidence that it causes good? Almost every study that has been done on sexually transmitted diseases has shown that homosexuals have 10 times more likelihood of contracting the disease than a heterosexual person, for example. What about homosexual families? When you have a family and then you have like children and so on, are they more likely or less likely, yes, to have pathologies, to be happy or sad, to have life satisfaction? Most psychological investigations have shown that it's not actually a favorable position to be in as a child, a homosexual father-father or mother-mother relationship. In fact, I was having a conversation with one of the demographers. His name is Nicholas Wolfinger. And he showed, he himself is an atheist, but he said, frankly, from my data, it is clear that a nuclear family, which is religious, is the best thing for children in a society in terms of criminality, delinquency, pathology, all these markers. So from a psychological perspective, from a biological perspective, from a societal perspective, all the consequences which you could see as being harmful, you cannot really make an argument that homosexuality is consequently good for everybody when all of these markers indicate the opposite, for example. So then one will say, okay, I don't care about that. What's the other option? The other option is categorical imperatives. And Immanuel Kant basically said that if something is seen to be, if everyone does it in society, the society will be dysfunctional. For example, lying. If everyone lies, a society will become dysfunctional. He considered suicide. If everyone done suicide, the society would be dysfunctional. So he said these things are cardinal sins. You can't do them. He doesn't believe in religion. He's an atheist, I think. Kant was probably an atheist. We don't know for sure, but he was probably an atheist. He said that's how you know what right and wrong is. Okay, so let's use exactly the same methodology. And we say if everyone was a homosexual, there would be no future generations. So that must be wrong as well then. So on a consequentialist morality, it's wrong. On a categorical morality, it's wrong. So on what basis now is it right? Oh, because so long as you're not harming anyone else, you can do what you want. But how do you prove that that's true? That is how you establish morality. That's how I would argue with them. Because they assume that you are wrong in your morality and your morality must conform with their liberal moralities. But their liberal moralities have assumptions that are uninvestigated or unproven. So if you remember the way I've just done that, this is how I would, because morality itself has to come from somewhere.
If I can just probe further into that question, there's two concepts within Islam. The concept of one concept is the concept of mu'amalat, so the rights that people and the creation have over an individual that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given. The other concept is the rights of Allah, so ibadat. Mm. So a common question that you've probably gotten in your travels in Pakistan was that, it's similar to this issue, that why does God need us to worship him? So perhaps you can analyze that question and perhaps discuss why it's not an appropriate or a correct question to ask.
Whenever someone asks a question, you've got to investigate the assumptions of that question. Now, if we look at it in terms of form, a question can't be right or wrong, okay? A question cannot be right or wrong, but the assumptions of a question can be right or wrong. This is actually, if you look at Aristotle's book, The Organon, this book was, he mentions these kind of logical propositions, but this is basic stuff, basic logic. A question can't be right or wrong, because it's not making a truth claim. But a question can have an assumption which is right or wrong. So for example, if someone said, who created God? Now the question is not wrong to ask that. You can ask that question. You're not making a truth claim. But the assumption of the question is that who created the uncreated one? The assumption allows for the possibility of impossible state of affairs. It's like a squared circle. For example, if someone said, can God create a rock so heavy that he can't lift it? The question itself is not wrong, but the assumptions of the question are contradictory, because the existence of such a rock would disprove God's existence, because the idea is God is powerful over all things. So on this question, which is why does God need us to worship him, we're effectively saying the following. We're effectively saying, why does the one without need such and such? The answer is, just like we did with the other two examples, we would say, the question has contradictory assumptions. That God is needy and not needy at the same time. We've never made the claim that God needs us to worship him. You know, when Allah says, وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنْسَ لَلْيَعْبُدُونَ, we have not created the jinn and the ins except that they may worship me. مَا أُرِيدُ مِنْهُمْ مِنْ رِزْقٍ, I don't want any provision from them and I don't need them to feed me. So he made it very clear that this idea of worshipping God is for the benefit of humankind. It's not for the benefit of God. So that's how I would answer the question.
JazakAllah khair. We'll take another question, perhaps from the sisters.
Yes, let's get some from the sisters as well, please.
Yeah, we have any questions from the sisters, inshallah.
Don't be shy. I mean, this is a... Yeah, go on. Whoever spoke, continue speaking.
No questions for the moment? Yeah, we'll come back to them in a second.
Okay, I'll come back.
Bismillah.
I have a question.
Yes.
Is it a good idea usually to use man-made laws or scientific, looking at the current state of scientific knowledge, using man-made laws, for example, the conservation of energy to prove the existence of God?
No, I mean, these laws, scientific laws, I wouldn't use them to prove God's existence. Usually they are used in objection to some arguments of God's existence. But for example, the laws of thermodynamics, the conservation, the zeroth law, the first law, the second law, third law, and the fourth law. Sometimes people can use those laws as a means of responding to some of the things. So for example, entropy is the tendency of something to move towards disorder. Yes? That's effectively what it is. Some scientists even use the term randomness. So it's randomness. They'll say that. They say, I thought you said there was no such thing as randomness, when entropy, for example, is a movement towards disorder, you see. Well, actually, first and foremost, when they say disorder, order, they don't mean the same kind of disorder that would negate irregularity or stability or uniformity, because when they say disorder, they mean something which is non-correlative, something which we don't understand the correlation of. But then you go back to an epistemic claim. If you're saying we don't understand the correlation of it, we can only say it's disorder vis-a-vis the human being's understanding of it. We don't understand the order of it. We as the human beings don't understand. So we go back to Laplace, because Laplace will tell you that, yes, that's the whole point. If you don't understand something, it doesn't mean it isn't true. So for example, if I, he gave a billiard example or like a pool example. I don't understand how all these balls came together and touched and all these kind of things. I don't get it. I consider that to be disorder. I consider that to be randomness. But we go back to the point that this is an epistemic claim, for example. So what I would say is, usually I would not use these laws to try and prove God's existence. Quite to the contrary, and especially when you get into quantum physics, I mean, the situation becomes even more complicated, frankly. And because within quantum physics, you have all these different schools of thought, competing schools of thought, you know, which, frankly, it just throws the cat in with the pigeons. So I wouldn't use, because especially with physics in general, it's quite a volatile science in the sense that every 10 years, they change their ideas. Genuinely, I remember going to school and doing physics some 10, 15 years ago. I was looking at A-level, I don't know if you guys have A-levels here, if it's the same system, yeah? Something like that, yeah? I was looking at A-level physics, AS physics, and I was looking at the book. Genuinely, like 30% of the book is out of date, meaning the new ideas of physics would now replace these ideas. So if something is susceptible to this level of change, how can I use it to prove God's existence? Because it can easily change. Physics is a very volatile science. It can change very quickly. What you consider to be fact today is unlikely to remain as considered fact the next 20, 30 years. So, and it's all dependent, because you have, very famously, there's a book called The Structures of Scientific Revolution, right, by Thomas Kuhn. And he was talking about the differences between Newtonian and Einsteinian physics, where there's a paradigm shift, there's complete paradigm shifts in physics. Something so volatile I would never try and use, you see, for proof of God's existence. I would only use in response to those who object using certain principles or laws which maybe they've misunderstood or equivocate in a certain manner with. Next question. Let's have some female participation as well.
Do we have a question from the sisters? I have one question that I'll ask at the end. It's more appropriate to ask at the very end of the talk. So it's the brother there, inshallah, if you can ask.
First of all, JazakAllah khair for coming over.
Of course.
So the question is, what is your view about using the scientific evidence and science in the Quran to prove the Quran is infallible?
Yeah, so it's going back to the issue. I wouldn't use it in the way that it's been used by the likes of Zakir Naik and Maurice Boqvar. I think that's an incorrect... It has many problems if using like that, because the way that they structure the argument is as follows. They say, these are scientific facts. For example, Big Bang, okay? And then the Quran says, أَوَلَمْ يَرَى الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا أَنَّمَا السَّمَوَاتِ وَالْأَرْضَ كَانَتَ رَتْقًا فَفَتَقْنَاهُمَا وَجَعَلْنَا مِنَ الْمَاءِ كُلَّ شَيْءٍ حَيٍّ. That you've got an ayah in the Quran that says that the heavens and the earth were sewn together and then God cleft them asunder. And that's referring to the Big Bang. And therefore, Islam is true because it's talking about the Big Bang. This is the structure of the argument. There's a few issues with this. Number one issue is, the Big Bang itself is a model of the universe and how it started, right? But there are many different models. In fact, like I was listening to Penrose recently, Roger Penrose, and he was having a conversation with William Lane Craig, and he said, I changed my mind. He literally just said, I changed my mind. Like 10 years ago, I had this idea because he's an authority in physics. And then now I've come to another idea, you see? So some people are even moving away from Big Bang theory as an explanation of the universe, beginning of the universe. So if we try and use it as some way of proving the Quran, one objection could be, well, we don't even believe in the Big Bang. And that could be an objection that some atheists can bring to the fore in the next, especially 10 to 15 years, when new models of the beginning of the universe can be found. The second and more problematic thing is, I'm giving this example because it's a common one, is that if you look at Tafsir al-Tabari, for example, which is one of the most authoritative and ancient tafsirs on the topic, he mentions that this verse could have four different meanings. And meaning one is this, meaning two is this, meaning three is this, meaning four is this. So this is an ambiguous verse. And if it's an ambiguous verse, it goes to what Allah says in Quran, مِنْهُ آيَاتٌ مُحْكَمَاتٌ هُنَّ أُمُّ الْكِتَابِ وَأُخَرُ مُتَشَابِهَاتٌ. that there are some verses in the Quran which are ambiguous and some of them which is unambiguous. فَأَمَّا الَّذِينَ فِي قُلُوبِهِمْ زَيْغٌ فَيَتَّبِعُونَ مَا تَشَابَهَ مِنْهُ ابْتِغَاءَ الْفِتْنَةِ وَابْتِغَاءَ تَأْوِيلِهِ وَمَا يَعْلَمُ تَأْوِيلَهُ إِلَّا اللَّهُ. That there are some people that would follow the ambiguous verses. So what I'm saying is, a lot of the naturalistic verses are frankly, they're ambiguous. You don't know for sure what Allah meant for sure. So you cannot say for sure this is talking about Big Bang. And it gets quite out of hand sometimes and wrong. Because I'll give you another example which he uses, and he's used many times, is وَالْأَرْضَ بَعْدَ ذَلِكَ دَحَاهَا in Surah Al-Nazi'at. He says that means that Allah created the earth like an egg, like an ostrich's egg. I'm not sure if you ever come across this. These are some of the scientific miracle stuff. Now, the word dahaha does not mean ostrich egg in the Arabic language. This is a lie, actually, in the Quran. There's no one that said that. Sorry to say, it's wrong to say that this means ostrich egg. It doesn't mean ostrich egg at all. It just means that Allah, He smoothed the earth. Now, if someone wanted to say that therefore the Quran talks about the earth being around, and now you have the flat earther that was going to make kufr of the Quran. But anyway, that's a different story. I always believe that the earth is flat. But what I'm saying is this, is that number one, there's ambiguity. Number two, you can't say for sure that the science is not going to change. But there's a third issue as well, which is when someone does this over and over again, if someone then is exposed to the opposite tafsir, for example, Al-Qurtubi, you'd be surprised to find, he says the earth is flat. He is a mufassir of the Quran. He says, وَالْأَرْضَ وَأَلْقَيْنَا فِيهَا رَوَاسِيَ وَأَنْبَتْنَا فِيهَا. He says, أَبَدَدَنَاهَا means the earth is flat. He even says, Al-Qurtubi, he's a big time mufassir, says the Quran says the earth is flat and there's ijma' on it. So now you've tried to prove the Quran is true, round from the Quran, using ayah and whatever. The non-believer or the enemy of Islam, he can do the same thing with the tafsir, which says the exact opposite of what you want to do. And he can have some kind of a claim. So how do you solve this issue? What I say about the naturalistic verses as follows. I say there are some scholars of the past who looked at the Quran, for example, the rotundity of the earth, the issue of the roundness of the earth, who said the earth was round. For example, Ibn Hazm, he says, if you look in chapter 39, verse 5, يُكَوِّرُ اللَّيْلَ عَنْ النَّهَارِ وَيُكَوِّرُ النَّهَارَ عَنْ اللَّيْلِ وَسَخَّرَ الشَّمْسَ وَالْقَمَرِ كُلٌّ يَجِرِي لِأَجَلٍ مُسَمَّى, that he rolled the day into the night and rolled the night into the day. Ibn Hazm, who was 450, he's very early, he said this, there's no way that this rolling process can take place because the word yukawir comes from kura, means ball. He says it cannot mean anything, it has to be round. So Ibn Hazm had the complete opposite view to Al-Qurtubi, and he came before him, in fact. Ibn Taymiyyah had the view. He said, there's ijma' that the earth is round, in fact. Al-Ghazali had the view. He said, okay. So what are we seeing here? We're seeing two different approaches, two different opinions among the ancients as how to explain the shape of the earth. So we have ta'wil going on. Because clearly, if it was so clear-cut, there would not be these different opinions. Now, what kind of argument would I make? I would say the Quran is the only religious book that has the capacity for ta'wil on issues relating to modern day science, which are observable. Like, for example, the Bible. There is nothing in the Bible that indicates or can indicate or anyone has taken to indicate that the earth is round, only that the earth is flat. Now, the closest someone can find is in the book of Isaiah chapter 40 verse 22, which talks about the circle of the earth. This is in the Bible, in chapter 40 verse 22. John Walton, who is one of the scholars of Christianity and biblical scholar, he said, this doesn't mean the earth is round, it means it's like a disc. They used to believe the earth is like a disc. Yani, there's nothing in the Bible to even allude to the fact that the earth is round. No scholar of the past that have used biblical verses to say that the earth is round. In fact, all of them said it was flat. Ijma', that is a true ijma'. Whereas the Quran, with certain issues like the rotundity of the earth, the universe and its expansion, all these issues, you'll find some scholars saying this and some scholars saying that. And it seems to me that Islam is the only ancient religion which has this capacity. So, for example, you can be a Muslim and believe in Big Bang. You can believe in the expansion universe. You can believe in the rotundity of the earth. You can believe in dinosaurs. You can believe in all these things. It doesn't go against your religion to believe in any of these things, because there's nothing in the Quran to contradict any of that. Whereas if you are a true literalist Bible believer, you couldn't believe in any of those things. That's why they have young age creationists. They don't believe in the dinosaurs, because they say, how can you have dinosaurs when the earth is only, the universe is 6,000 years? Because that's, they believe that. And they have these museums in America with Adam and Eve walking around with a dinosaur. Because they say it was 6,000 years. So what I'm saying is, the way the argument is made is not sophisticated. I'll be honest with you. But there can be an argument that is made which is sophisticated, which, because sometimes they also say it couldn't have been known at the time. Like the fact the earth was round could not have been. But there's many people that said the earth was round before Islam. Pythagoras said the earth was round. Like, I can give you maybe five. Aristotle, Pythagoras, this one, that one. There's many people that the Greeks believed in the earth was round. So couldn't have been known at the time is too strong of a claim to make. So they need to be more academic the way this is phrased. But the way I would put it is to say that is the Quran is the only book which yahtamilu ta'wil, that allows you to believe in current cosmological and biological realities without committing blasphemy, because the text itself indicates a possibility of those notions. Whereas the Bible, for example, if taken on literalistic grounds, does not have the same flexibility. Yeah, okay. But after it'll be him after, yeah. Go on.
Actually, we had Hamza Kim here last year and made a really nice presentation on this last topic. Yeah. But one follow-up question I would have is, okay, I agree that you shouldn't use scientific like argument because it's very weak, but there's a lot of people that came to Islam and found Islam and believed in Islam through that sort of argument and through that belief. What would you say to that person?
I would just say to them, the way I just expressed it, because it's not like everything that these guys were saying was false. It's not like everything, all the examples used were جَعَلْنَا مِنَ الْمَاءِ كُلَّ شَيْءٍ. Even the alaqa, you know, the human being was created from alaqa. I don't see them as bad examples. But you just have to be a bit more nuanced in making the point. You can't make strong claims without strong evidence. So for example, you cannot say, it couldn't have been known at the time. Whether I can find you someone who said it before. Like, you know, if we did what you call the history of science, you could find someone, or you could say, it only has one interpretation. Or this is talking about the Big Bang. Don't be too categorical in these things, because if you soften it up, it actually becomes a stronger argument. If that makes sense. It's not like there's nothing there. There is something there when it comes to the science and the naturalistic phenomena, but it's just the way you package the argument. Do you see the point? Because an argument is only good if it's not susceptible to a counterattack. You see? What makes a good argument? An argument is good if it's not susceptible to a counterattack immediately. There's no point throwing a punch if you're going to get a punch back that's going to knock you out. You know, what kind of punch is that? You know? Yes, sir.
Can you just tell us about the role of artificial intelligence in Islam? Is there any compatibility with the Sharia laws? We are talking a lot of nowadays AI. So,
okay.
What's your opinion about this?
My opinion about this is that artificial intelligence is just a matter of input and output. That's all it is. So all of computer science is two things. It's two things, including artificial intelligence. It's loops and conditionals. That's all it is. It's loops and conditionals. I mean, the whole thing is loops and conditionals. Artificial intelligence has a limit, and that limit depends on the inputter. Artificial intelligence, robots, all of this stuff has a limit, and the limit is it will never develop first-person subjective experience. It will never have consciousness. It will never have any of this stuff. It's impossible for it to have this stuff because it does not have consciousness. And so artificial intelligence is effectively loops and conditionals. It's an elaborative calculator. It's like you have, you know, the calculator that you have, that you put 2 plus 2 equals 4. It's just like that, but it's more sophisticated. So it's nothing to fear. We should embrace in artificial intelligence and use it for our own purposes.
JazakAllah khair. There's one question, a personal question I'd like to ask.
Yes.
But I think everyone can really relate to this question. There's a lot of talk of theory they've been discussing and practicalities as well. And you've been using a lot of big words like theories and other long words. what's other? Oh, that's my... say again. Oh. The question I'd like to ask is a personal question on your own experience dealing with this question for yourself. Because I feel in the day and age that we live in, we all tackle this question, maybe not head to head, but we all have to rationalize or deal with this question about religion and is Islam the true religion. It's almost like we have to accept Islam before, even as a Muslim, we have to accept Islam. So from my perspective, I memorized the Quran, alhamdulillah. So when I was starting to ask these questions, I looked at the Quran. And it's free from contradictions. It has a very simple theology. There's one God. He sends messengers. It's very clear. Then I look into the Prophet ﷺ, and understanding the seerah, it becomes clear that this isn't a person who is a liar. This isn't a person who has any kind of bad character. And that helped me understand any of the issues that non-Muslims or even Muslims, they have about some aspects of the seerah of the Prophet ﷺ. What was clear to me was that this man, he cannot be immoral. It might be difficult for us to understand why something was done, but that was clear for me. So I wanted to ask you personally, yourself, how did you start asking these questions? How did you go about answering these questions and rationalizing Islam for yourself? Perhaps at a time when you were younger, and at a time, if you can recall, when you weren't exactly 6'7" as you are today. Mm-hmm. I know that's probably difficult to consider.
I was still quite tall.
No.
I mean, I think I started my personal journey, I think, really started when I was 13. I believe that. Because we had YouTube and all that kind of stuff back then, 13, 14. I'm 32 now. I'm not that old, you know. So this was, I don't know how many years ago. That was like almost 20 years now, actually, really, if you think about it. And what happened was, let me come down a bit.
Oh, dear.
Well, I just started asking questions. I started listening to all the different worldviews. Atheism never was attractive to me. I thought it was always false. Like it was, I didn't understand what. Because I was kind of growing up at a time where new atheism was on a rise, right? And as a 13-year-old, I think I actually did see through some of the behaviors of the new atheist propagandists. I knew that these were just evangelizers, probably making money from this. So I wasn't attracted to that. I just wanted to know for sure. I think my gripe was the question that was asked before, which is, how do we know that the Quran and Islam is true? That was something I really wanted to understand for myself. And I'll be honest, one thing that really, when I started to get into it, be powerful as the best argument for me, the best one, not the prophecies, not any of that, was actually the language of the Quran. So when I was growing up, I was exposed to Noman Ali Khan, okay? He's a very famous, and he was doing this tafsir of Quran and stuff like that. And he kept mentioning this guy, his name is Fadl al-Samarra'i, right? And this guy, he's like an Iraqi grammarian. He's still alive today, by the way, he's from Iraq. He's clean shaven, and he's written these books in Arabic. At that time, I couldn't even read them or understand them, but I wanted to get to a stage where I could read and understand what this guy is saying, because I was very interested in it. And so I started kind of learning like classical Arabic, because I come from Egyptian background, but we don't speak classical Arabic. We speak Egyptian Arabic, which is almost a different language altogether. So I had some time to do that with my mother and stuff. Very blessed to do that. And then afterwards, I started looking at his videos, Fadl al-Samarra'i. And he had this very interesting book called Min al-Shakk ila al-Yaqeen, From Doubt to Certainty. This book that you can still get to this day. And he goes through these arguments, and basically what he's doing is he's showing why the verses of the Quran, that they are linguistically superior. Like the delicacy of why the word choice of each word. And it's, I mean, if you want an English alternative to it, probably the best thing that is out there now is Divine Speech by Noam Ali Khan. I think it's in part or in full taken from Fadl al-Samarra'i. It's effectively a translation of some of his works in Arabic language. But I started to get really interested in that. I think I exhausted this guy's videos. I loved them. I loved the linguistic stuff. So after a while, I started realizing that this book could not be the product of human design or artificial intelligence, or could not be, because it had to be. There's no way a man could produce this effectively. Now, why and how, that requires seminars and I've given you already some references that you can check. But I was pretty sure at a young age, okay, there's no way this could be manufactured by a human being. So it was the strongest thing was the linguistic argument. I started to get into that. When I got into that, there was a point where, like, even now when I recite the Quran, sometimes I think deeply and say, there's no way this can be, human being can make that. Look, I've read a lot of philosophy in my life. Not at that age, but now I've read a lot of, like, the greatest thinkers in the Western world, in the Eastern world, like the literacy stuff. I used to teach English. I know what good prose looks like. I know what good poetry looks like. I get it. But this, when it comes to the Quran, I was pretty sure that there's no way that human being could construct this. So for me, that was the strongest argument. Once that argument was made to me, I was convinced. But there was also a spiritual aspect, because I did suffer from doubts when I was younger as well. And I think, subhanAllah, when you suffer from doubts and stuff like that, sometimes you come back stronger. And because you start having this curiosity and this thirst, and you want all the answers and all these kind of things. And I do remember going to Alexandria, where I'm originally from Egypt, and they were doing Taraweeh prayers. I made dua to Allah to keep me very certain, and I believe Allah responded to that dua. So there was a spiritual component and an intellectual component, and I think they came together. And that's how I got to the stage where I am right now.
JazakAllah khair. That's perhaps a method that many of us who don't speak Arabic can't really relate to, but it's interesting that it was unique to yourself. And there are so many different aspects that you can approach the Quran, whether it is through the scientific, the Quran mentions scientifically, or whether it's linguistically, the prophecies and the seerah of the Prophet
ﷺ.
There's so many ways that you can be attracted to the religion of Islam, which is very beautiful. There's one question that I have from the sisters, inshallah. I believe they were slightly intimidated to ask you the question.
Don't try and patronize them, okay?
I'm just wondering. I don't understand what the reason for that is.
I'm always right activist, you see.
I understand. Yeah. It's just when I sit behind you in the car, it gets quite squished. I'm definitely not intimidated, but you know, it's something to consider. The question was, what is, if there's one thing that we should take from this gathering today, from this talk and from the Q&A, that you would like all of us to take from this gathering that we have, what would that be?
I think I want people to be critical. I want people to be critical of those who are critical of Islam. Because I realized that a lot of us, I mean, when I was in Pakistan, I was doing this tour, and I realized that a lot of people have what is referred to as the Goro complex, which is this inferiority complex to white people and white civilization, or Western civilization, let's be more specific. And a lot of the questions that are asked about Islam, whether it's to do with gender, or whether it's to do with punitive laws, or whatever it is, they almost always have assumptions which come from the Western knowledge productions. And so what I want people to understand, to question the question, I think the main thing is, you need to be critical to those who are being critical. That's what I would say the main thing is. Because we're asked a lot, as a community, as a Muslim community across the West, we're asked a lot of questions about our religion, about ourselves, about our religion, vis-a-vis community, society, etc. And we're always on the back foot. And I feel that that's a posture that we don't need to no longer be in that posture. We can now respond. And we can ask, and we can criticize as well. So that's what I would encourage.
Fantastic. JazakAllah khair. We'll take one more question, inshallah.
I want to ask two different questions. Your enthusiasm to learn when you were 13. I just want to highlight how important was your focus into philosophy, and you said I was too much into linguistic. When you talk about philosophy and you go back to the original, like the Imam, the Arabic, and the Imam Ghazali, and so on, how much did you learn from those people? And to highlight the importance of moving from Arabic and the likes of those people who did fight against the Qadariya and Jahaniya and all of those, and the likes of them now in the West. And the second part of the question, when we talk about gender and gender identity, whether it's right or wrong. Some people, we have the junta and they can move to male and female and so on. Our position towards those, in a couple of speak, the woman, when you meet someone like this person who claims to be a she, well, it's a he, and how we have to address those people.
Okay, so on the first question, to be honest with you, I think the best kind of learning is that which is done through curiosity. Like when someone is genuinely curious to know the answer of a question, like in pedagogy, they refer to this as discovery learning. And it's interesting to see, like I teach my kids how to swim, but I realize that I don't actually teach my kids how to swim. I let them discover how to swim because they know how to, like my son now is better swimmer than me. So like, I don't know how he's done it. He's doing these flips and all these kind of things, and he's only 7 years old. But I put him in the water, I showed him a couple of moves, and now he's doing all this stuff, and I'm thinking, what the hell is going on here? How can the pupil outrun the master in such a short space of time? Because he's discovered new ways of swimming that I hadn't discovered before. In fact, he's taught me now, Yanni. It's now becoming quite an embarrassing thing. I have to get him a swimming instructor so he can go to the next level. So, but the point I'm making to you is, the best kind of knowledge is that which is on the back of a genuine curiosity that someone has. Like someone is genuinely curious. And I was genuinely curious. And that's why whatever I'm saying to you right now is that, did I sit and memorize these verses and these names and these things? No, I didn't memorize any of that. It's just that I was curious to find out the answer when I was 16 years old or something. And the answer was so significant to me that I remember it 16 years later. That's basically it. Like most of the questions that have been asked, I have had a personal and emotional relationship with the answers to these questions. So that's the first thing. I think that, you know, when you're curious, and if you make learning fun, as cliche as it may sound, if you enjoy to learn about something and you wanna, or if you're curious to learn, if you make it like this, then learning becomes a much more interesting thing. If you don't find interest in it, it's not about learning then, it's about learning how to learn. We don't need to learn. We need to learn how to learn. You see? So that's the first thing. The second thing as it relates to gender identity. Look, there's a difference between someone who's intersex, yani, a khuntha who's got like, for instance, yani, male genitalia and female genitalia at the same time. And there are some people like this. And they classified them in books of fiqh as the khuntha mushkil. Okay, there's different types of khuntha. So this intersex person, khuntha mushkil, is the one who exhibits both male and female organs or whatever. So what the fuqaha traditionally said is that they will be identified with that which is more dominant. What about those, for example, who have a very equal amount of like male and female reproductive tissue or however you want to put it, and it's not XY or XXY, it's like XXY. And there are people like this. This situation, it might go move to a psychological discussion. If it's so balanced biologically, then this is the only situation where we would actually go to someone and say, what do you identify with more? Seriously, if someone is in that scenario, what do you identify with more? Do you feel like this more or do you feel like this more? And in this situation, something can be done by way of, okay, well, if you identify with this more, then you're not this. So you have to negate the other aspects of your personality. Because all of us have some feminine and masculine traits. There are androgynous women. Androgynous means masculine. There's another big word for you to write down in your piece of paper.
And the other one was rotundity.
You know that one. Yes, pretty dumb. And there are very feminine men. And you're one of them, of course, yeah? I'm only kidding. I don't know I'm picking on you. But we all have some of that. You know, there are some men with so much masculinity, which they need some more femininity. Like myself, for example. I suffer from this problem.
Are we recording this issue. Part? Yeah, so did we
I
have
suffer.
The recording?
But the truth of the matter is this, is that in terms of those who do the surgery, like if that's what we're talking about, someone who actually does the SRS surgery, this is obviously not allowed in Islam. It's irreversible damage. If you look at, there's actually a book written by by Abigail Schreider, I think her name is, called irreversible damage, which shows you the amount of people that when they do this surgery, they regret it afterwards. It's not a good idea. And now, like, they're talking about doing it for children. I mean, for people under a certain age, I mean, this is abusive. I mean, frankly, I mean, they talk about FGM in Muslim countries. Why do they talk about FGM in Muslim countries when they're doing FGM in the West? This is FGM. This is effectively female genital mutilation. Now, someone could argue, well, they're doing it through consent because they're mutilating their genitalia, but with their own consent. I will say, in response, when the WHO, the World Health Organization, when they speak about FGM for the Muslim world, they don't differentiate between the ones who do it consensually and the ones who don't do it consensually. So for them, any kind of circumcision of a female is considered to be female genital mutilation. So if that's the case, tell me why labiaplasty is not, for example, that. Or SGS is not that. See, you see, they package the amputation, effectively, of male or the reconstruction of female genitalia, they package that as liberation in the West. But when it happens in the East, it's mutilation. So one man's mutilation is another man's liberation. It's unbelievable, really, isn't it?
With that, we'll have to conclude because we do have to evacuate the building by 5 o'clock. So if you can all assist me in doing so, inshallah.
MashaAllah. Thank you very much. Thank you. Oh, fantastic. Excellent. Oh, fantastic. Oh, beautiful. I appreciate this. I'll take that one as well. Okay.